97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
Trying to get Dwayne Patterson on the line here, but you know, Sue, as I was wrapping up the hour, I looked up at the television screen, and we have several screens in here. We have Fox National, but we have Fox 2 on one of the screens, and you know, this is one of the stories that's kind of making the rounds today. There is video that's come out of something that happened at a McDonald's in July where there was one of these teen takeovers. But of course, what the local media and what the Post is doing is they're leading with what the cop did. And the headline says, video shows cop fire shots into car full of teens on chaotic July night in St. Louis County. I suppose that's somewhat accurate, but I would lead with the fact that there were teens that were going crazy and taking over an entire area on the night of July 5th. And when you see this video, so the Post is going to focus on the cops, right? Probably the rest of the media. When you see the video, I think you'll say, wait a second, what about all the crazy teenagers and what they're doing right now? Because it got out of control. This was like almost like a nighttime version of what happened at the the Shrewsbury Sky Zone a couple of months ago. That was horrific because it was literally in the middle of the day. It was like 3-4 in the afternoon. In this particular case, it was late at night, I think maybe even into the overnight hours. But it fits a pattern here with these teenagers, you know, with no parents, of course, out late at night and doing no good and being in a situation where, yeah, they can get shot by cops if they do something that warrants that. Now, I'll get into this a little bit later because apparently the audio shows that one of the cops was firing and one of the other officers said, whoa, no, holster, holster. So I don't have audio, but yeah. So of course this is going to be about the cop and what the cop did outside of, you know, what happened. He fired 11 times, and the story, I can do this now, I think, because we still don't have Dwayne on. The shots hit a boy and a girl in the car. The girl hit by broken glass was treated, released. The department said the teens who were shot were 15 and 16. So, you know, I guess here's more. The Ethical Society of Police, this is the group that represents black officers. I don't know why the Ethical Society of Police always takes up for criminals, but they do. They express concerns that the officer fired multiple rounds into a car occupied by teenagers. The circumstances surrounding the use of deadly force must be fully examined, including the nature of the perceived threat, whether the vehicle was moving toward the officer away from the scene, whether the officer's actions were consistent with department policy and accepted law enforcement standards. So again, this is going to be all about the cops and what the cops did. This happened 45 days ago. St. Louis County prosecutors, I guess, are going to look at the video for review. But, you know, one of the things that they point out in the Post story is that nobody has been arrested with this. And if you see the video, this is crazy. You know, we talked about this with my friend Dan O'Donnell yesterday, who's up in Milwaukee. They had one of these things that happened at the Wisconsin State Fair, right, which is in Milwaukee, on Sunday night. And it was just nuts because they're down the midway of this state fair, which is an awesome state fair. And kids are just going nuts, and they're knocking people over, and they're swinging at some of the white kids. So I don't know. I'll be very curious. We haven't had, you know, there's one thing that the Post-Dispatch loves to do, anything else, is focus on their cop hatred and at every turn try to make the police look like the bad guys when things are falling apart amongst us. But this is what they do at the Post-Dispatch, so it's not anything new. Do we have Dwayne? Do we have him on the magical new button here? Okay, look at that. Dwayne Patterson.
Magical.
Testing. Are you there?
I am here. Hello, my friends. Hello, wow. Sue. Hello, Mark. How are you?
You sound like you're right next to me, which is what we wanted to be. You're out in California, but we're using some of
Dwayne's world.
Yeah, that's right. Some of this technology. How are you?
I am doing grand. I've been beating socialists off with a stick all day and finally got the gremlins out of the electronics.
Oh, good. Why? What's been going on? Just hiccups and stuff like that?
Just hiccups.
Okay. It happens. Where do you want to start? You want to start with Florida and what happened there yesterday? Because there is a Democrat socialist that was victorious, right? God bless him.
Yes, because you need the undercard to El Sayed. And if you're going to nationalize this election, the back-to-back of El Sayed and Ms. Nixon down in Florida is just too glorious to behold. So just quickly, what's the over-under on how badly, what's the spread going to be in Florida between Ashley Moody over Ms. Nixon? What do you think it's going to be, Mark?
Before I handicap that, let's play some greatest hits here. Okay, ready?
Okay, I want to abolish for-profit prisons because I believe right now people aren't educating our children and they're ushering them into the school-to-prison pipeline because they want to exploit labor.
Now is the time for us to stand up and lock arms and be willful accomplices in this fight against fascism.
To be 1D, the clerk will unlock the machine and the members will proceed to vote. Have all members voted?
Oh my gosh. So, yeah, we have to end fascism, even though she's a communist. So, that's going to be a fun one to watch. I don't think that's a seat that's in jeopardy.
That's going to be a 20 point spread, maybe a 25 point spread in Florida. Joe Scarborough on M Snow, as I like to call it this morning. Joe Scarborough on the Morning Joe program asked her if she still wanted to defund the police, and she hemmed and hawed, didn't really want to answer it. She said, well, what I am for is I'm for law and order, and law and order begins with the release of the Epstein files. That's what she said this morning. So it's like, oh, boy.
They're still on that thing, right?
She's still on that thing. I'm so flabbergasted at El Sayed. I mean, again, we're going to be ping-ponging between these two. For the next, better part of 3 months. El Sayed gives a press conference today, and a reporter asked him today, I don't know if you've had this grab yet.
I don't think I have, no.
Okay, this happened while you were on, while we were on Hugh's show. And he's asked by a reporter, so how are you going to win back the black vote, especially in Detroit, that you got hammered on in the primary? And he says, well, puts his hand on his chest to show sincerity.
Right.
And he says, well, I am African. And he says, I'm embracing my African heritage. And that's how he's going to win back blacks.
That's his answer.
That was his answer. He's Egyptian. Do you know what the Egyptians did to black people for about the last 400 years? Traded them as slaves. Put them in bondage in Egypt. They didn't actually completely get out from under slavery. They were one of the last countries to do so. I think it was finally in the 1920s before they finally said, okay, I guess we're done with this since everybody doesn't like it and all.
You know,
you can't make it up.
No, but it is interesting because, one thing that's been consistent when you look at Francesca Hong or if you look at El Sayed, and I'm guessing if you look at what happened with Angie Nixon in Florida, African-American voters did not support them. They do not like socialist candidates. I find that interesting.
Oh, I find it absolutely fascinating as well. When you've got a Republican candidate in a street fair doing a parade of classic cars, and he's riding in a 50s era, 60s era restored cherry red Ford pickup truck with the white walls on it, and the comms guy, the undercard for El Sayed, one of his campaign coordinators, takes to X and says, well, just the fact that he had two American flags on that Ford pickup truck shows that's the same thing as the KKK doing a march and a rally.
It's ridiculous. They've tried to make these comparisons before. And look, I think most common sense people who love this country, which I still think is the majority of the people in this country, think that that's just such nonsense. It's just weak. Weak
it's
sauce.
It's not going to work. It'll work in New York City, where it was an enclave of hard left progressives. It will work in San Francisco. It will work in Berkeley. It will work in pockets of the country because you have a bunch of progressives on college campuses or in inner cities that think they don't have enough goodies and they want everything for free. Remember 15 years ago when the Democrats and Barack Obama said that if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor? That's now gone. There is no you're going to keep your doctor if you like your doctor because your health insurance is going to be absolutely destroyed. It has to go. It can't remain if you're going to have a public option.
People don't like to stop telling the truth on that because people don't like to really think through that. right? They really don't. And I think, and I remember, by the way, I was told that by Senator McCaskill back in the day, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. And they lied about so many things related to Obamacare.
Yeah. But,
but they are, the problem for Republicans is I don't think Republicans have good answers for this, because the bottom line is, and you know, this is when it comes to young people in particular, they're very worried about health care and the cost of health care. And it's real, all right? And if you don't have a job in particular, but then again, there's this sense that you don't have to pay for health care insurance, right? But then all of a sudden when you get sick, well, then you get in. That's not how it works. And, you know,
no.
I've even talked about this. One of my pet peeves, Dwayne, is the claim by the Democrats, and they say it all the time, that Republicans are trying to take away coverage for pre-existing conditions. Republicans never answer the way they should, which is in 1997, I think Bill Clinton signed federal legislation that said that if you don't gap your insurance, so let's say you change jobs and there's a little bit of a gap between the next job. If you go on COBRA, if you don't skip your insurance, you cannot be denied coverage for pre-existing conditions. But the Democrats time and time again lie about that. Now, again, think through that. If you're someone who had a job, you had insurance, and you're like, I'm not going to pay for insurance. Uh-oh, now I'm sick. I got to pay for insurance. Well, of course you're not supposed to do that, because that's not how the pools work. You can't just have people going in willy-nilly to say I need insurance now because I'm sick. But that sometimes, I think, falls on deaf ears with the Democrats as well.
Of course it does. And the system, if you're going to do a universal single-payer system, which is what they want, it doesn't work, and no matter what you throw at it. But it can't. It doesn't even have a percentage chance of working unless everybody is dumped in it, whether they want to or not. And I'm just... Nobody, you think Elon Musk is going to get dumped into a public option? Do you think half the people in Congress, in the Senate, are going to get dumped into a public option after what they're going through? You think every military member on TRICARE is going to get dumped into that? No, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple other things here. The John Ossoff comment on Natalie Harp. I talked with Scott Jennings about this earlier. Here's part of that.
See, he doesn't want to do the job. He wants to build his ballroom and travel with Natalie on their apparently defenseless flying palace gifted by the Emir of Qatar.
Why'd you decide to invoke Natalie Harp specifically in that speech?
Here's the point. We're in wartime. The commander-in-chief has mired us in this geopolitical disaster. People have lost their lives. Our naval logistics are frayed. The global energy system is in crisis. And he retreats into this bubble of West Wing aides who are his security blanket to make him feel good about himself.
Okay, well, when I covered this with Jennings, I mean, the allegation on the part of John Ossoff about Natalie Harp is just outrageous, and there's nothing to it. And I can't believe that he hasn't been called out more by the legacy media, but that's stepping way over the line there.
Segment of today's show on Hugh's side on the network, which, by the way, was streamed on C-SPAN. They're picking us up this week because Congress is on vacation and
nice.
They just are desperate for stuff to play. So, sure.
Well, good for you. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. So, second segment, we brought on Michael Collins, who is going to be running against John Ossoff in November. And he wasted no time, and he was pummeling John Ossoff. And he said, look, comments like that, that kind of misogyny, that kind of abuse, there's no truck for that with Georgians. And they're not gonna take too kindly to that. And he started going down the list of all the things that John Ossoff promised Georgians but did not deliver on. And that's going to be a horse race there. Don't fool yourself that's a dead set lock for the Democrats to hold. I'm not convinced of that at all.
Well,
Michael Collins is coming.
Yeah, that whole thing, you know, even that was Jen Psaki who asked the question on, what do you call it now? M. Snow. I like that. I got to practice
Snow.
That.
Yes.
She even sounded caught off guard, maybe a little disappointed. I mean, why would he do that? He's making allegations that are deep into the weeds here that might be sexual. When you know as well as I do, if someone on the right said that about someone and made a reference like that, that would all be about misogyny and hating women and all that.
But that would be the end of all things.
Right.
Yes.
But they're not treating that this way. I mean, even Jennings said, I didn't see the panel last night, that they're, you know, some of the people on the panel with Abby were defending this. I don't know how you can defend the comment whatsoever. So that's fascinating. What else should we talk about here? How about the mayor of Massachusetts that doesn't speak English?
Hi, guys.
How are you,
no
Mr.
Mayor?
Excuse me.
God bless you.
Brian DePaine is his name. You heard the lawyer say he doesn't speak English. What? He's
well,
the mayor of a U.S. town.
Well, and he'd qualify to be a truck driver in California.
Well, that's actually a very good point. He's got criminal charges now because there's fraud and money laundering charges. And I don't know if he speaks English or not, but the lawyer tries to shoo people away from that. But that's rather, let's take the fraud and the stolen money out of the picture here. A mayor of a United States city doesn't speak English. What in the world is going on?
Well, that clearly is problematic. I mean, I remember reading stories, 10 years ago when I kind of do some silly stuff. I remember there were towns that that elected a ceremonial mayor that was actually a four-legged person, or a dog as mayor, or a 9-year-old as mayor. You see those kind of stories, just lighthearted, off the front page type stuff, but. A guy that's actually running and actually has a budget and is in charge of how a city is run that doesn't speak the Queen's English or even, Bronx English for that matter, that does become problematic. The cut I'm surprised you haven't glommed onto. Did you see the steering committee of the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America? This was a Zoom meeting of about four or five of these little dweebs that are running and steering the national platform committee of the DSA. And this guy says, there's two things that we are famous for. Number one are all the programs and agenda that we want to do to this country. And the second is our hatred. He actually used the words, our hatred of the United States Constitution. Everything
well,
we want to do.
Yeah, I haven't
everything,
gotten that audio.
Everything we want to do, he says, is to enable a democracy and get to a democracy in this country that is the only democracy that is stable and can work, and that's a socialist democracy, whatever that definition means. And the biggest objective has always been and will be until we dismantle it. The biggest objective to our goal is the Constitution. We have to end the Constitution.
Yeah, what I hope is, and believe it or not, I've heard a little of this maybe on CNN, but look, there is healthy skepticism among sane Democrats about this stuff, but they just don't know how to handle it. They really don't. And I think that's the pickle that they're in. Again, even Joe Scarborough, you've seen some of the more traditional, establishment Democrats go after these DSA candidates saying, we're not down with that, like James Carville. But those guys are not really relevant into where the Democrats are picking their leaders right now. So that opinion might not even matter.
Not at all. And Republicans, we know how to stick them with that and hang that around their neck like an albatross. We're really good at that and doing the oppo. What we need to do better, and I think our mutual friend Jim Talent and I are going to work on a National Review piece, we need to sell the message that things actually are improving here. I mean, you talk about the medical affordability crisis and health insurance. Has anybody talked this week that prescription drugs dropped in price significantly for the first time in like 60 years?
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. It hasn't happened before. And it's only happened because of one person, right?
I think so. I mean, I'm not too crazy about gas prices and everything, but I do think you have to give attention
Patience
to issues like
opera.
That. Well, no, I
Patience
mean, look, I know. Opera. And then, look, the thing that bothers me is that no one wants to give credit to, about the big, beautiful bill and the tax cuts, because everyone's taxes would have gone up if that didn't pass. All right, one more topic here. Darlene Graham, she is trying to replace her late brother, Lindsey Graham. There's a debate in North Carolina. She's asked by Greta Van Susteren, Senator, Are Taiwan and the South China Sea national security issues for the United States? If so, why and how? And her answer was, look, I'm just going to be honest here. I'm not that informed on national security, but I do support the military. That didn't play well in the room. However, I don't know that it wasn't a dishonest answer. Is that problematic for her in North Carolina, since other people are going to make that maybe an issue of her not being ready for that particular seat?
I don't think so. I don't think that just because Lindsey Graham was a foreign policy expert and that's what floated his boat means that's what has to float her boat. She's going to have different issues. But my guess is, and I've heard her say this before, that on issues that she's not aware of, while she's getting herself up to speed on them, she is largely going to vote the way that Lindsey Graham would have voted
on sense.
Those issues.
Yeah.
And I'm just fine with that. She doesn't have to be the chair of the Armed Services Committee just because Lindsey Graham was on it, or, you know, on Judiciary or whatever committee it was. He was a lawyer. I'm not sure she was or is. She's going to have her own strength. She's her own person. But she was close enough to Lindsey Graham. She kind of knows the pith of his gist. She knows what he liked and what he didn't like. And my guess is she wants to keep his legacy alive. Yeah. I'm okay with that.
The bottom line is that you could probably ask a lot of current members of the legislature what their opinion of that particular geopolitical situation would be, and they wouldn't really have a good answer. So I don't think, you know, trying to answer and fake people out when you don't know the answer, that's a bad move. Just being honest with people about this, I think, is much better for her. So we'll see where that takes us. By the way, we did this like video experiment today with Dwayne, and if you're watching on the YouTube or the Twitter, I can't see you, but apparently people can see you and I. How about that?
Well, you see, and I'm seeing myself the whole time. I'm not seeing you guys, but I'm assuming that somebody in the outside world is seeing the two of us together like we can actually see each other.
Wait, I got to see you because, like, I got to pull this up on the Twitter. Is it like that on the Twitter too, Ethan? This is like a new...
Well, yeah.
I was told about this, Sue, when I came in today, right? I'm like, we're going to do this video thing with guests.
You look to that screen to the right.
I know, but when I look to the right, there it is. Then my face goes, look, you look very handsome there. You've been kind of dressed up for us a little bit.
Hey, I put on the sport coat.
Yes,
I've got
did.
The... I've got Dwayne's World behind me. That's actually the bookshelf in my living room that I built with my own two hands.
I got collar issues with my golf shirt because I was at Belle Reve for the BMW Championship today. Dwayne, have a great week. We'll talk next week.
You got
All
it.
Right,
thanks,
take
guys.
Care. I think I've talked about the cocaine scandal at Penn State University with the fraternities, but this is quite something. You now have 14 people charged, including the father, who's a big-time lawyer of one of the frat brothers. So you have 13 current or former students, as well as that student's father, facing felony or misdemeanor charges. Four defendants are currently students at Penn State. Something tells me they will not be there this semester, is what I'm guessing. But here's the AG in Pennsylvania.
The evidence showed that cocaine was primarily packaged at the fraternity houses, and that packaging was done by fraternity brothers and oftentimes pledges.
So the investigation was dubbed Operation Drugs Unlimited, and it found that two members of the group, Agostino Abbiatello and Thomas Robinson, were alleged to have been the main suppliers to the group, roles that included making regular trips to Philadelphia and New York for large quantities of cocaine. The cocaine was then packaged and cut primarily at the Delta Upsilon and Sigma Chi fraternity houses. Now, I'm just going to be honest with you, ladies and gentlemen, and those of us who are of a certain age, you might say, this sounds like something that very well could have happened in the mid-1980s or even the early 1990s, because I think the white powdery substance was a little bit more popular, although I've been told that it's made a comeback, and maybe this is evidence that it has. So officials say they tracked how the cocaine was obtained and packaged and sold. Most of the payments were made in cash or via payment apps like Venmo. Here's the AG again.
There was nothing junior or childlike about this type of conduct. This was an upper-level trafficking organization for this region in Pennsylvania.
Here's the cops in Pennsylvania talking about their part of the investigation.
We learned about it through the same way we learn about a lot of different drug trafficking organizations, and that's through good old-fashioned police work. We realized that something was happening there, and we just started working it like we would work any other case. We took time to make sure we could identify and arrest as many of the individuals as possible so that we could root out this organization and stop the flow of cocaine into Penn State.
Maybe part of it is people used to deal weed. They can't make any money doing that. They decided to make money this way. But the one part of the story that's fascinating is the father that also was charged and how much he knew. We'll have to find out what really happened in the coming month. So we're experimenting with some new modern technology. It's called video this afternoon, Sue. And we have some of the guests. Dwayne Patterson was on a video feed. I think Curtis Hauk is there. Testing. One, two, three. Can you actually see me right now, Curtis?
Yes, I can.
Wow. You're a little light on that microphone. I'm going to jack that up a little bit. All right. Hey, there you are. How are you, Curtis Hauk?
Hey, good to be with you, my friend.
You know, it's so funny because
live
I have
in color.
Yes, we have. It's funny, though, because I've known a little bit of what you look like. But look, we've never met in person. I have these relationships with people like Dwayne Patterson, my previous guest, is a great example. We really get along even outside of the show. We have some things in common. And there are people that I never probably will meet in person. Maybe I will, but you might be one of those people, Curtis Hauk. But how are you? It's great to have you on.
Doing good. You never know. I may come to the race at Gateway one year or come to see a Cards or Blues game when my Nats or Caps are in town. You never know.
Oh, you come in here and I will take good care of you. Are you a NASCAR guy? Is that what I just heard?
Yes.
Okay, awesome.
NASCAR guys, an IndyCar F1. So this weekend, I'm excited for the Grand Prix in D.C.
One of my dear friends, and he would love to entertain you if you came in town, we'd go to a baseball game, is the legendary Kenny Wallace, Rusty's brother. But man, he's an amazingly kind and, you know, generous human being. He's one of my favorite people on the planet. So real important part of the show as well. All right, let's talk about some stuff here. Look, I had Scott Jennings on a couple of hours ago, and he was able to rip on the the John Ossoff situation. I want you to explain this just a little bit, because you have a United States senator that basically made an allegation that the president is traveling around with a 35-year-old staffer and having an affair with her. I mean, that was pretty blatantly what he said, and I think even some people on the left were a little, you know, off-put by that. But that's not getting a lot of attention, is it?
Well, and the fact that they're not really talking about it on the networks is proof that they're a little uneasy about it, I would say. ABC, CBS, NBC, they haven't really mentioned it. MS Now, not really. CNN has really only done it a few times in context of, oh, he got Donald Trump upset. You know, look at how good-looking John Ossoff is and all the usual nonsense that we have here, other than the brother that was on Aaron Burnett last night. But that's been documented before in the few New York Times stories that have been done about Natalie Harp, pointing out that there's family tensions, political tensions that, you know, you see in a lot of families in America. It's just unfortunately that hers is a lot more public. She tragically lost her father a number of years ago. So I think that explains a lot of her closeness to Donald Trump, needing a father figure in her life. But I actually knew Natalie many years ago. She was a host at One America News, OAN. And she was one of the first people to give me a weekly media appearance. It started just with the previous host of her time slot, but her team kept me around. And so I spent many months on her show every week talking about the news of the day. So I owe a lot to her in terms of giving me the reps. You know this, Mark, a lot of this job, you don't really get anywhere get good at it without the consistent reps. And she did that for me.
So, you know, in what he did, and here's what, you know, you guys have written about this, and Scott was telling me about this because I didn't hear the segment. But one of the questions I asked him a couple hours ago is, you had people on your panel that were defending this? And he said, oh, yeah, they were right. You got the transcript on Newsbusters.
Right. Yeah. And the thing that I have to say, too, is the double standard here, you know, and also that this woman, Natalie Harp, is not a cabinet official. She's not the press secretary. It's very unseemly to begin with. But those people, at least, Mark, are before the cameras. They're public facing, whereas Natalie Harp is known as a body man or body woman. That really only people who know politics closely know. They're very important, but they're not facing, you know, they're not doing interviews,
right,
so to speak.
There's a lot of those people behind the scenes.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. Curtis Hauk, managing editor of Newsbusters at the Media Research Center. Let me ask you about the, I talked about this yesterday. I played the audio of Terry Moran. This is an interesting story because Terry Moran is the guy that went on late night, probably with a few glasses of wine or something like that, and said some things about Stephen Miller that got him fired at ABC. But interestingly enough, he goes on a podcast called The Fifth Column, and he tells this fascinating story about how ABC spiked a story that he was going to do on the origins of COVID-19. And I found that fascinating, didn't you?
Yeah, in the fact that they asked him why, and he simply said Fauci, that somehow Fauci was turned into some sort of editor-in-chief for the day when it came to this story, and that he had so much power that he basically spiked it. He had problems with it, and that ABC said, you know, more or less boiled it down to the point that Terry Moran in the clip for those that didn't hear it on your show yesterday, that he didn't watch the package, and he doesn't want to because it was unrecognizable that the changes that were made that he was told boiled it down, watered it down to nothing resembling what he had originally planned. And that should be a way bigger story and something that he should have talked about, you know, fairly early on when he left ABC News. The fact that he kind of made it such an afterthought, or that it's coming out now, obviously because of Fauci being in the news, but I think that's such a seismic example of censorship. That should be something that you want people to know about pretty early. But, you know, I don't know what goes on in the mind of Karen Moran.
It's the exact opposite of what the news network should have been doing. They did it before with Amy Rubach, who came out and very clearly said, look, she was going to do an interview with Virginia Guffier, the Epstein accuser, and they spiked it. They didn't think that it was, you know, meeting their standards when, in fact, it did, and they spiked that story as well. So, look, the other thing that he addressed, and this is sort of, you know, maybe burying the lead a little bit, because the guy that hosted the podcast, Michael Moynihan, when, you know, Terry Moran is asked whether or not ABC News is a liberal institution, he says, yes, but I think a lot like mainstream media, it's because of lack of viewpoint diversity. That was one of the problems in covering Trump. Nobody had voted for him. I couldn't be more in agreement with that. It is a lack of viewpoint diversity. And I've had conversations. I was talking about this yesterday with Dave Kerpius, who's the J School Dean at the University of Missouri, my alma mater. I think that he told me he believes in viewpoint diversity in a newsroom. But man, nobody's really putting any viewpoint diversity in a newsroom, which is the problem.
Yeah, you have it exactly right. You have people that identify the problem. Chuck Todd has done this many, many times over the years, brought up the lack of platforming or knowing people in your life or geographical biases as well. That's obviously a huge part of the equation. But then, are we going to do something about it? Oh,
no.
Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not.
That becomes, you know, it's part one, part two. And last I checked, 50% is still failure.
I think you're right. That's good math. And I'm not even good at math, right? I got to let earlier here. We had a great event. I don't know. Are you into golf? You mentioned a lot of sports. You like golf?
I've been following your clips.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to watch this.
Senator Schmidt was out today with Scottie Scheffler. The BMW Championship starts tomorrow morning. I'm going to give folks a little bit of a update and the latest preview. But Curtis, you have a great week. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, take care, my friend. Congrats on all this.
It was good to see you on the video. How about that? All right, we'll see you. Take care. So I was slow rolling a little bit this morning. I knew I was going to go out to the Pro-Am for the BMW, but there was rain, and I had gotten the email that they had delayed it, right? So then I get this message from Dan Reardon, no relation, our golf expert, 9:31. You need to be out here. Scheffler is paired with Eric Schmidt.
Wow.
That certainly got my attention, Dan, and you lit a fire. I jumped in the shower, and I got out there in time to catch him on the eighth hole with Scotty, and we both got a chance to chat with the senator after nine holes, didn't we?
Yes, we did, although you didn't have 1,500 children yelling Scotty, Scotty, surrounding you while you did the interview.
That's the problem. So they both came off at the same time, and everyone was looking to Scheffler for autographs. Some people wanted Schmidt's autograph. I'm not sure if they knew who he was. But here's what I'm going to do. I have not heard your short interview. I'm going to play yours and mine back-to-back as audio cut of the day because I gave him a little trouble. I don't know if you heard what I did. So he's coming on 8, and he's behind the green on that's a par 5, isn't it? 8. So he pitches one over the green toward the spectators. He says, 4. It didn't really come that close to people, but then as he kind of came toward his ball, I said, Schmidt, what are you trying to do? Kill people over here? And I had to heckle him a little bit. But then that son of a gun, you know what he does after that? He chips up to like within 2 feet of the damn pin. He's a good golfer. He really is. And I have to admit that.
He is a good player, but I'll tell you, I was on to the right of the fairway on 5, and his drive went right over my head, hit the building next to me, and landed 10 feet from me. He can hit the ball, but he doesn't always know where it's going.
Well, that was true. Let's face it. That was true of a lot of the amateurs today. But any other things? I was out there for a couple hours. I saw a couple of different groups. I was following Matthew Tkachuk for a while. Matthew had a great man. He hit the rough on the left side on 18, Dan, and it was a muddy ball with not good, you know, not a good lie. And he, with his strength, just cranked it out of there, got it on the green. It was a really impressive shot. But any observations that you took away from the practice rounds and the Pro-Am today leading into the start tomorrow?
I won't go into a lot of detail. Very impressed with Rory McIlroy when he came in. He had plenty to say about a lot of things, all of them positive for the most part, but he easily owned the line maybe of the week. He was asked by one of the writers reasonably early in the interview with the apparent demise of LIV. Mm-hmm. He was asked, Rory, there could be a couple players that could come over to the PGA Tour and be of value to the tour. Do you think that would be a good idea? And Rory hesitated and said, well, were they of value to LIV?
That's a great answer.
That's going to go around the world.
And it should.
The thing that I'm struck by is how much respect these players have and almost fear of the unleashed Scottie Scheffler. Rory simply said, he's going to be player of the year, even though Rory's in consideration, because they just believe this guy is better than them. And if any, I it's not Tiger-like, but they literally do fear that the unleashed of Scottie Scheffler is somebody they can't handle. And so it'll be interesting to see when the start of the tournament gets underway tomorrow. You know, Scotty birdied four of the first five holes he played in that group. Senator Schmidt was doing a lot of fist pumping as they went through. But that's what and the other thing is, these players are so happy to be out of the heat.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, yeah.
They're all in a good mood because they expected to come here and get broiled again, and they're not. And they're all in a good mood, at least until the golf course starts taking a little bit of toll on them.
Yeah, so I was talking to, I can't even remember who I was talking to. It might have been Alex Noren after the round. And I asked him about 17 because 17 is a beast of a hole. They moved the tee box back. You and I have talked about this. It's the hole that Tiger went into the creek on. But they have made the creek maybe a little bit more of a hazard and put it more in play. And then what he said, look, that is a long, long hole. And with the wet conditions, it was even longer. Now, the good news is for the players, that's going to dry up in the next couple of days. And those greens are going to get faster by Saturday too, right?
And I asked Rory the question. I said, you know, Brooks Koepka has 63 in the second round at the PGA, and then Tiger closed with a 64. And I said, are there scores like this in the golf course? He said, given the moist conditions that we've had through the early part of the week, he thinks that tomorrow and Friday we could see some really good scores being posted. And then it's a toss of the coin afterwards. And I did hear a few players talking about if you are in the rough, you're not probably going to reach the green. And yesterday, I forget who was talking about that said, if you miss the greens and you're in the rough around the greens, you can't chip. So there's a lot of things, balls in the air, but everything's in a very positive direction is the way I would describe it. No glitches, no problems like that. And like I said, the players are just in such good spirits.
I love it. So, yeah. They were great today with the kids. I saw a lot of autographs and the kids and everyone was really good.
And Adam Scott, who played here and finished third in 2018, said, when I came onto the grounds and I saw the buildup on this golf course, I was reminded of what it felt like to be with these galleries in 2018, and it put me in a good mood. I thought that was a wonderful comment.
Look, the course looks beautiful. The setup is outstanding. If you have not been out there yet and you're going the next few days, you're going to have a blast. Dan, I'll see you out there. I'm taking the next 2 days off. That's how dedicated I am, so we'll see you then.
Enjoy tomorrow.
All right, we're going to play Dan's interview with Eric. Here we go.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
So this actually was a bit of a coordination because they're coming off nine. Eric's going to continue to play the rest of the golf course, but Scotty's done. But people are trying to get autographs, and they're yelling Scotty's name. So Dan's on one side of the ropes. I'm on the other side. I said to him, hey, if you get Schmidt, make sure that he knows I'm over here. And Dan said, yeah, you too. But Dan got him first here.
Eric Schmidt, he just spent 2 hours on the golf course with the greatest player in the world. What did you learn from him that might help your game?
That I've got a long way to go, but he's just so consistent. I mean, every shot, he's very consistent. He's got a great sort of attitude about the game, very laid back, but mechanically just sort of flawless. So it was fun. I mean, I learned a lot, and he's a great guy, so we got a chance to spend some time together, too.
You've been an athlete your whole life. When did golf come up on your menu?
You know, not until relatively recently. I was a baseball player, so it wasn't the same season for me. I wish I would have played when I was younger, so I got my job playing. But no, I love
that. Oh, my God, the audio.
Wow.
You know, it's a great way to connect with people. It's athletic. I get to play with the president and Scottie Scheffler. I would have never imagined that as a kid growing up in Bridgeton, Missouri.
Final question. It's the three-parter. Best part of your game, worst part of your game, and most memorable round?
Today would probably be the most memorable round, I guess, right? Best part of my game, usually off the tee. I can get it down there a little bit. And then I would say my 60-yard wedge, is I need some work to get it closer to give myself more birdie or par opportunities. But, you know, I'm an 8.5. I feel pretty good about that. Still more work to do, which is what's great about golf. It's constantly improving.
Yeah, so he's an 8.5 handicap. He's a good golfer. He really is. You can make bad shots. Everybody does. But here's my comment. So anyway, everyone's yelling, Scotty. Scotty walks by. Eric comes over to me.
How much fun was that, first of all?
I mean, it's a thrill of a lifetime. He's the greatest golfer in the world, right? And to get to spend a couple hours playing golf with him is just fantastic. So incredible golfer, great human being, and it was a lot of fun. I had my wife and my youngest daughter with me too, so it's a pretty special day.
So had you played with him before? Because you played with Bryson, you played with the president. Had you played with Scotty?
No, I hadn't.
Okay.
And I didn't know until yesterday they did the draws last night of who I was going to play with. So I was ecstatic to be able to play with Scotty.
And how'd you do here? How'd you do on here?
I played pretty well, okay. I think. I mean, you know, I think he did better. That's fair to say, but I played pretty well.
Little errant shot. I was watching you on 8, a little errant shot. You almost hit the crowd.
Well,
I was concerned about that.
There was a heckler on the other side.
That was me.
Was really obnoxious.
But
I recognized him before.
But your putt was beautiful, right?
It's kind of like life. You just kind of have to stick with it, right? So
now you struggled on 9, didn't you?
That's fake news.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. And one more question. When they introduced you on the tee box, they had to have said, here's the official former state senator of the Mark Reardon Show, right? Okay, good.
You scripted that, right?
Thank you. Yes, all right, see you, man. Right, take care, Eric.
Oh, his humble beginnings. You know, we're good friends, and it's awesome to see him. I'm just going to tell you, I'm jealous. When Dan sent that to me this morning, I'm like, that son of a gun. I mean, he played with Bryson not too long ago. He is living the dream,
and he's
a great senator as well. Sue, I will see you and your brother at the BMW on Saturday.
Love it.
For the listeners, maybe I'll run into some of you, and we'll be back on Monday afternoon.
Get more at 971talk.com.